Stunned silence.
What is this?
We do a little bit of a show.
So I must be doing something. Right?
And a dance break or something.
Tell us what you mean.
Like, I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool.
You're tuned to the 15 Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 163 for June 2021. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got the one and only Gavin. How are you, mate?
Good, thanks, James. Happy June.
Happy June to you too. Yes, great to talk to you, and always great to talk to the wonderful Anna. How are you, Anna?
I am well, James. Thank you.
Lovely to talk to you, and lovely to talk to the one, the only, the Don. How are you, Don?
I'm very good, thank you.
Very good. Good to talk to you all. Yes, here we are in June. Winter is starting to, I don't know, put its icy claws into, you know, my cold feet a little bit in here, here in New Zealand. How are things over there in Australia, guys?
Probably quite a bit colder. And I'm not sure about icy claws into one's feet. That's a new one for me. But if that were a thing, then that's happening here too.
I mean, depending on where he, like, I mean, when you say, I just asked you to speak for an entire country that crosses a number of time zones and a number of subclimates, but where you guys are, it'll be cold, I'm sure.
It's quite cold here.
Yeah. I think we've had some parts near where we are have had a little bit of snow already.
Oh,
and we've had many frosts and a few minus twos and threes. So, you know, just another day at the proverbial office.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, you know, it's important to get your views on the weather and your views on most things. And in fact, that leads into our first story with a seamless segue to begin. This is from catholic.org.nz. The views of every Catholic in Aotearoa New Zealand will be sought during an expanded Synod of Bishops process announced by Pope Francis. The Pope has asked all Catholic dioceses around the world to start consulting with parishioners from October the 17th to get local level views that bishops will take to the 16th Assembly of the Synod of Bishops in Rome in 2023. Cardinal John Dew, President of the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Conference, the NZCBC, says each of the country's six dioceses has been asked to consult parishioners about still-to-be-announced matters to be considered at the Assembly, he says, implying intrigue that I don't know was meant to be there. Quote, the Holy Father wants to hear the voices of all the baptized, said Cardinal John, the Archbishop of Wellington. He believes the time is ripe for a wider participation of the people of God in a decision-making process that affects the whole church and everyone in it. Regular assemblies of the Synod of Bishops have been held in Rome since Pope Paul VI created them in 1965 following the Second Vatican Council. The most recent regular assembly was Young People, Faith and Vocational Discernment in 2018, which produced the apostolic exhortation Christus Vivit. It was followed by the special Amazon Assembly in 2019, which resulted in the exhortation Querida Amazonia. The next regular assembly, titled For a Synodal Church, Communion, Participation and Mission, was scheduled for next year, but on 21st of May, Pope Francis postponed it to October 2023 to widen it to include consultations with local parishes, bishops' conferences, and regional groupings of bishops. Cardinal John says each bishop will appoint representatives to lead the consultations in their diocese. Quote, after that consultation, the New Zealand bishops will meet early next year to listen to what the Spirit has inspired in the churches entrusted to us, end quote. The NZCBC will then prepare a report for the Federation of Catholic Bishops' Conferences in Oceania, a regional grouping that includes many of the South Pacific Island states, Australia, and New Zealand. That regional body and others like it around the world will draft documents that will go to the Synod office in Rome to help prepare the Assembly's working document. So there's a lot of, consultation and processes and groups and things being asked to sort of gather. Is this a big deal, Gavin? This next synod on a synodal church, communion, participation, and mission, and being asked for your opinions. The Pope wants to hear from everyone, every baptized person. That includes you. You're baptized, aren't you, Gavin?
I was in a small church in Glen Innes, I believe.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. It is. I think it's an enhanced process of other synods of bishops, but I remember that the Synod of Bishops on the Family, there was a questionnaire that was sent around and people were asked for their views. I don't know whether anyone else remembers that. But in a sense, the process is not new, but I think the layers of the process, sort of there being a national level and then a sort of regional level, if you want to call it that, so where the bishops' conferences of a particular region gather for discussion and consultation and the drafting of papers, and then this actual assembly of the Synod of Bishops in 2023 now. So it is an enhancement of a process that already exists. So there's a feeling here in the Church in Australia, where I think we've spoken before about the fact that the Church in Australia is undertaking what's called a plenary council, which is a national assembly, at which the bishops will have what's called a deliberative vote in terms of changing potentially some of the laws of the church and trying to understand a lot of the language here about, you know, understanding what the Spirit is saying and that sort of thing is the language of synodality, a church that listens to one another. So here in Australia, there's been a lot of discussion around this concept for the last 3 or more years with the plenary council. So there is a sense here in Australia, I guess, that it's a little bit, okay, well, where does this fit in with the plenary council? Because that's an important national process. So here, the process will be sort of running somewhat in parallel with the plenary council process. In New Zealand, no doubt, there'll be some very interesting discussions around a number of matters, as there were here with the plenary council. People asked for their views on the question that was asked here was, what do you think God is asking of us in Australia at this time? Which was not necessarily the question that everybody answered. I think some people answered a question that they made up for themselves, like, what do I want the church to do that they don't do at the moment? Or how would I change the church if someone let me? So I think that's part of the challenge in a process of consultation, is helping sense what the Holy Spirit is actually saying. And, you know, that's not as simple as consensus. You know, we've spoken a little bit about that. I think the German synodal way, as it's called, and Pope Francis has cautioned the people there that are possibly going down some paths that aren't in line with the church, to say, well, you know, the church isn't a democracy. The church isn't a place for popularity, and what the greatest number want is what the church ought to do. So that's probably just another caution that might be offered in terms of this increasingly consultative process, that it's important that the views are analysed and considered in light of scripture, church tradition, papal teaching, and those sorts of things through the centuries.
Because it's a good point, consultative, Anna. We're not a democratic church. You know, it's not sort of take a popular vote on some of these things. Although, well, I don't know. There's a few times when maybe that was the case, depending on which council you're referring to. What do you make of this? And I mean, I do remember that survey, now that Gavin reminds me of it. But what do you make of this move by the Pope to expand the timeframe to allow for more consultation from more Catholics around the world on yet to be announced topics, he says?
Yeah, I probably feel a little bit cynical about it. Not that that the Pope's motives are, you know, somehow not good or whatever, but this whole consultation process, in light of the experience of the last 2 years of, you know, what's happened here in Australia, I think, and you know, as Gavin was saying, you know, people end up often sharing what they, you know, wish that the church would do or be and things like that. And sometimes that's quite, you know, that's an impossibility, that the church could never be what they would hope it to be. And I think it's very, like, there's millions of people in the world, and how do you actually really help them to know that their voice is actually heard? Because even in this national, you know, Australia-wide process that's happened, there were many people after the first sort of, what was it called
listening
again?
Listening and dialogue.
Well, yeah, the first process of submitting something, and then they put together a document, a very big document, to sort of sum up everything. But there were a lot of people unhappy with what was produced because they felt like what they said wasn't in there. And I kind of thought, well, how can every single thing be in there? So are we actually, is the church actually doing something that will just alienate people because they feel like they haven't actually really been listened to, even though the church has said, we want to hear what you have to say, but is the church really going to, or the bishops, really going to hear every single thing? And, you know, perhaps the attempt to consult the wider church is a little bit futile. I mean, you know, like perhaps that's kind of what we want people, we want to be consulted, but in reality, like, they're not necessarily going to just listen to what I say or what Gavin says or what Don says, you know, like, there's so many voices. And if they don't kind of take on what I say, and, you know, do I feel like I haven't been heard? Well, they asked for my opinion, but they haven't done anything with it. You know, it just sort of produces all that kind of stuff. And I wonder how fruitful it is, really, in the end.
I mean, they definitely will listen to what Don says. Like, we know that. But I'm with you. I mean, they probably won't listen as much to what I say. And you do have this problem about when you open up for consultation. Are you just doing it to say that you were consultative? Or are you genuinely looking for some sort of insight to come from the people with whom you are consulting? Don, what do you make of this, mate? I mean, obviously, like I say, the bishops and the Pope himself will be waiting to hear what you have to say. But for the rest of us plebs, you know, the other 1.2 billion, 3 billion, whatever it is, what do you think? Good idea? Or, you know, is it to tap into Anna's uncharacteristic cynicism? Is it something which is, you know, just a little bit of a box-ticking exercise? I don't know. What's your take, mate?
I think it's an absolutely terrible idea. It's an idea that's basically been tried in the Anglican Church with their synodal approach, and you look at where they are in the ordaining same-sex clergy, same blessing, same-sex unions, and doing a whole bunch of stuff that's incredibly unbiblical. And you look at their state and the conflict and their communion and in their church. And why would we invite that type of approach and that kind of division in our church? I mean, you've basically got a whole bunch of Catholics. If you look at some of the stats, in the West, you've got 50% of whom don't even believe in true presence. You've got probably the same amount in the West who don't necessarily disagree with same-sex marriage, and probably basically take a similar view on abortion. The issue in our church is not that people aren't being listened to. The issue in our church is that, especially in the West, is that a large majority of people who are kind of nominally or culturally Catholic aren't really Catholic. And we have not done a good job, despite having 60,000 children in our schools, of teaching actual Catholicism and doing catechesis. And you know, basically you have a large majority of the Catholic population aren't even properly formed, and we want their opinions. What are people thinking? This is not a priority at this time, and it's not a good idea.
Well, it'd be good to know what you really think, though. But I do take your point that I think I'm a little bit confused as to the sheer numbers that they're going to get responding. If we think about the last time when filling in the survey, and you know, I dutifully did that, and I don't know how much my views were rolled in, because by the time you're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands from our part of the world to millions to very quickly tens of millions, and then you know, hundreds of millions potentially responding to this, like what are they really looking for? And I also think that given that the church is becoming increasingly countercultural, your point's well made, Don, in terms of the average formation of the average Catholic. I don't know how you could map or chart that over time, but I would suggest it's probably going in a different direction to where it has gone historically. Do we really want everyone weighing in? Well, that's what the Pope's going to be doing, and all the bishops and everyone else. So we'll have to sort of see what the topics are, and B, whether there's any value in providing input, I guess.
May not be the last time we talk about this topic.
I think, especially since the Synod itself isn't going to actually be till 2023. So it looks like we've got a bit of time to sort of think about it and chew over the questions, and, you know, nothing quite like a speedy sort of process, you know.
We can make our own submission from the 15th station.
Just as long as, that's a good point, we could do the 15th station submission, but just as long as it's not our resignation, then we're fine. This is our next story from Crux. Although agreeing with him that the clerical abuse crisis is a catastrophe, Pope Francis rejected the resignation presented to him by German Cardinal Reinhard Marx as Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Munich. Quote, "You tell me that you are going through a moment of crisis, and not only you, but also the church in Germany is going through it," Francis wrote in a letter dated June 10th. "The whole church is in crisis because of the abuse matter. Moreover, the church today cannot take a step forward without addressing this crisis. The ostrich policy of hiding the head in the sand leads nowhere," the Pope argues, "and the only way to address the crisis is to address it from our paschal faith. The Catholic Church in Germany has long been struggling to address the clerical abuse crisis, with several top-ranking officials, including Marx and Cardinal Rainer Wolke of Cologne, accused of mishandling allegations. Marx, 67, had offered his resignation to Pope Francis on May the 21st, despite being 8 years shy of the mandatory retirement age of 75. In his letter, the prelate said that he wanted to take his share of responsibility for the catastrophe of sexual abuse by representatives of the Catholic Church. Quote, "First of all, thank you for your courage," Francis writes. "It is a Christian courage that does not fear the cross, does not fear to be humbled before the tremendous reality of sin." The Pope tells Marx he was right in describing the abuse crisis as a catastrophe and acknowledged the sad history of sexual abuse and the way the church dealt with it until recently. "To realize this hypocrisy in the way of living the faith is a grace. It is a first step that we must take. We have to take charge of history, both personally and as a community," Francis wrote. "We cannot remain indifferent in the face of this crime. To assume it supposes to put ourselves in crisis." Well, this is an interesting one, Anna. Just to recap, so you've got Cardinal Marx submitting his resignation because of his, trying to sort of take a little bit on his shoulders, I guess, in terms of the representative of the, you know, senior clerics in the church in Germany. And as we've talked before, even though I think, just to be really crisp in case it wasn't clear from this story, it's not saying that Cardinal Marx has been accused himself of any abuse, but rather his point around the crisis being partly due to priests being moved around and things, as we've talked about on the podcast before. Very interesting. What's your sort of take on all of it, Anna?
I think on one hand, I'm glad that his resignation wasn't accepted. Not because I think he is blameless, but I think, and maybe this is what, I haven't read, the entire letter from the response from Pope Francis, but, you know, I think he needs to remain where he is and deal with it and, like, do all the things that need to be done to help the process of this horrible scourge on the church. Like, and for him to just fall on his sword, I think is, to me, it seems like the easy way out. If there are charges to be laid at his feet for not necessarily the abuse itself, but for moving people around not doing what he should have done, then he needs to face that. And if he was going to resign and he was going to resign because he's been at fault, he should say, "I've been at fault. This is what I did. And I shouldn't have done it. And, you know, I accept whatever penalty comes to me." But it seems like he's trying to be a bit of a martyr without, and perhaps he's an innocent, you know, is what the term martyr suggests, I suppose. But I don't think he is. Whether there's some kind of criminal case to answer or whatever, I don't know. But And you know, the German church is in a real bad way, partly because of the abuse and partly because of this crazy synodal way that they're this path that they're going down, which is distancing them from the church, and it's really problematic. And he's a real mover and shaker in that area as well. I think he has to clean up the mess that he's made. I feel that's what he should be doing.
And I mean, it does feel like, well, I mean, it's, I was going to say it feels like that's what Pope Francis is saying, but it's kind of hard to get directly why the Pope rejected the resignation. I mean, the retirement, sorry, I said resignation. I'm just sort of reading back through. You know, it's important that we don't stick our head in the sand. Is he implying that that's what he's doing by resigning? I wonder. Don, what about you, mate? What do you make of this and the rejection of the resignation of Cardinal Marx?
His resignation should have been accepted, but for different reasons, and namely his positions on the blessing of same-sex unions and his position on the morning after pill in Catholic hospitals. So both of those positions basically should have excluded him from a position in the hierarchy in the first place, because both of them are basically against Catholic tradition and our biblical understanding of morality. So yes, it should have been accepted, but for different reasons than we've outlined. In that story.
Right. And what do you make of the call from the Pope around, you know, not sticking your head in the sand and being around to sort of face the music?
I certainly think, yeah, if he has things to answer, then or answer for, he should basically be made to answer for them in that position. And basically, I guess light is the best disinfectant. So let's shine some light there. I guess I don't really know what happened there or what the full story is. So light the way and let's see what disinfectant or light is the disinfectant will show up.
Yes. Yeah. Indeed. Gavin, what about you, mate? What's your sort of take? Do you sort of agree with agree? We've got one, we've got Anna saying, you know, he shouldn't resign because he should face the music. And we've got Don saying, yeah, he shouldn't resign because he should resign because of other reasons. What's your take on Cardinal Marx and also the Pope's response?
Well, it's a little bit confusing reading the various reports around the nature of how complicit he might have been in any cover-up or that sort of thing. As I think Anna said, that you know, there's not any allegations of him himself having abused anyone. It appears that he was taking a view that the leadership of the church has failed, and I don't think there's much argument that it's true that that has been the case in many, many places, and that he's had a position of leadership within the church for a number of years in various dioceses and with other posts, including I think the head of the European bishops at one point. So therefore he is part of the problem, and therefore he was resigning as sort of a bit of a gesture that leaders within the church ought to be taking responsibility. Now, it seems that it raised a number of eyebrows among other bishops, because, and I saw on social media and other places questions of this nature. Well, if he's resigning, why not every other bishop in the world, essentially, if that's the position that he's taking? So I think there is it's a difficult thing to look at and say, okay, well, if a particular person, a bishop or whomever, has been accused of something concrete, whether that's their own abuse or the cover-up of it, then this would seem to make sense. But it's not clear from what I've read. There has been some reporting suggesting that he does have some clouds hanging over him, but others that say that there aren't necessarily. So I think it was just a source of some confusion as to why he had chosen to do this and why at this time. Certainly there are other bishops in Germany who ought to be considering this course of action, And I think the Pope might be more willing to accept their resignations if they were offered. So, yeah, I was just perplexed by it, and I think a number of people were. And I don't know if I have a particular view whether it ought to have been accepted or not. I think there's a case to be made either way. Don mentions things not related at all to the issue of child sexual abuse that make people wonder whether he's the right person to be leading such an important diocese in Germany. But my head's still being scratched as I try and ponder what this was all about and what it was supposed to mean. I mean, certainly some survivor groups were felt it was an important gesture that was made, and the views of survivors are important in all of these sorts of matters. But I got the sense that there just wasn't the backstory to make the case for him to resign in this way, other than it to be a gesture for the wrongs that have been committed by others. And I think this is an ongoing challenge for the church and for the current bishops and other leaders within the church, being framed as still part of the problem when that may well not be the case. And in fact, in many cases, they're part of the solution and have proven to be so. And I'm not sure there's anything to be gained when people call for the heads of current bishops, essentially for the sins of their predecessors or their predecessor's predecessor. So I think there's a caution that I'd offer there for bishops and those calling for their resignations, how they act in this particular area, because I struggle to see the, other than something symbolic, the benefit of someone who has done nothing wrong resigning for the sins of others.
It's not justice, right? Like, well, you don't feel like justice has been...
No, and it's interesting. You try and compare it with some other... The church is not like any other structure in the world, really. But you think about corporates. You know, sometimes a chair or a CEO resigns for something when they really had... They weren't at fault at all. But there's a contemporaneous nature of it. They were in the hot seat when something happened. You know, I think if a bishop today were in the hot seat, you know, sitting in his cathedra, probably not literally, but and something happened in his diocese that was just inexcusable and unforgivable in this area, that there would be a case for him to offer his resignation in that same sense of, you know, responsibility as the leader of a diocese. But I think to offer that resignation seemingly because of what happened 2, 3, 4 decades ago just leaves a sort of bit of a sour taste in my mouth.
It's a good point. I think it's a really good point, actually. It does feel symbolic, like you say, and I don't think symbols is what we need. I think what we need is action, and in many cases, you know, these bishops are best placed, and the cardinals definitely are best placed to actually make the changes necessary so that we never have abuse again in the church.
And there does seem to be a sense from some of the commentary when he did offer his resignation that he had made some positive steps, and, you know, people saying, oh, well, he shouldn't resign, but this other guy definitely should, and, you know, that they may well be right. But I think if it's true, and I've read some stuff from one of the Vatican's key movers and shakers in this area, who gave the suggestion that he had been somebody who had made positive progress in this area. And yeah, the last thing we need is the people who are, you know, forging that path to make the reforms that are necessary. And frankly, in many countries, including the two from which we're recording tonight, so much progress has been made. But in many countries, that's still very much in train, and that can't be derailed if someone's making progress. That shouldn't be derailed by some effort to send a symbolic gesture.
Yeah, it's a real I 100% agree with that. Like, progress has been so not slow, but so challenging in this, you know, terrible situation, that any progress that is being made must be safe, must be protected and extended. So, you know, making a resignation for show, I'm not really a big fan of. But I think addressing the specific failings, and there are plenty of them, is exactly what we need to be doing. Speaking of failings in the church, unfortunately, here's another one. This is from DH News. Archbishop J. Michael Miller of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Vancouver is offering an apology for the role of the Catholic Church played in Canada's residential school system. The apology comes after First Nation announced in late May that the remains of 215 students had been found buried on the grounds of the Kamloops Indian Residential School. Operating from 1890 until 1978, the British Columbian School was the largest institution in the Indian Affairs residential school system. Quote, "I am writing to express my deep apology and profound condolences to the families and communities that have been devastated by this horrific news," Miller said in a Twitter thread. "Each time new evidence of a tragedy is revealed or another victim comes forward, countless wounds are reopened, and I know that you experience renewed suffering. I wish to apologize sincerely and profoundly to the survivors and their families, as well as to all those subsequently affected, for the anguish caused by the deplorable conduct of those Catholics who perpetrated mistreatment of any kind in these residential schools. The Catholic Church," he continues, "was unquestionably wrong in implementing a government colonialist policy which resulted in devastation for children, families, and communities." Yes, Don, this is a pretty macabre sort of finding, obviously, without yet knowing any of the details of how these students died. I mean, this is over nearly 100 years, well, over 100 years ago and over nearly 100-year period. Something's not quite right, obviously. And so an interesting apology here from the Archbishop. What did you make of this or of the story in general, mate?
I guess I haven't really looked too deep into it, but yeah, obviously tragic. 213 people in a kind of mass grave. And obviously, I don't really know a lot of detail about how they died or what the circumstances around their deaths were. Obviously, any child that dies is incredibly sad and incredibly tragic. I guess this was 100 years ago, and that's tragic. On our doorsteps today, in America alone, there's a million children that die every year, and no one basically bats an eyelid. So if we have a minute silence for everyone, every child that's been killed since Roe v. Wade, we'd have 100 years of silence. So that'll bring into context some of the proportions that we're talking about. And any child that dies is incredibly sad, and I think we should have the same kind of focus and the same kind of sadness when we look at those 213 kids as we do the killed children that are being they are being killed today and perhaps even more horrific fashions, dismembered and beheaded with forceps and clamps. So it's just basically a mass disconnect there that you have Canada united and basically grieving for these individuals and basically not batting eyelid when there's hundreds of thousands of others basically being torn apart today.
I think that's a very fair point. It's something which I think one of the things I struggle with this, Gavin, is the abortion comparison is a fair one, and it's definitely, there's nothing and this is the problem, we don't have any of the details because they still haven't come out. The story's been going around for a few weeks, not the apology story, the actual story of the remains of the students, without yet much clarity into how they died. You know, was it through natural causes and they just weren't, given a proper burial in a graveyard, or is it something a bit more nefarious? If it's the latter, and it becomes yet another example of where innocent, because I don't care what a student does, nothing that they do deserves you know, to end their life. You come back to the connection of the slaughtering of innocents, and it's just not a good thing. But I mean, I don't know. What are you making of this, mate? And what are you making of the apology and the wording of the apology as well?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion around Pope Francis's words. I think he expressed regret or deep pain or something like that. And certainly a number of people from the First Nations, the Indigenous communities in Canada, were very disappointed that he hadn't apologised on behalf of the church. And, you know, sort of harkens back a little bit to the story we've just spoken about. You know, where does an apology lie, or where does responsibility lie? I think there would have been some benefit in Pope Francis having apologised. But I guess until we know the circumstances of what's happened, there's a sense in which, and, you know, it's important that we remember that the government was part of this this program. The church ran the school, and the church is hardly without blame of whatever happened, whether it's, you know, not burying children in a way that respects their human dignity, whether, as you say, James, is something more sinister and nefarious than that. The church is right to apologize for what happened. Certainly there's, you know, some issues that are somewhat comparable, maybe not in terms of the remains of dead students being found, but certainly the church was a partner with the government in Australia and what's known here as the Stolen Generations, where Indigenous children were taken from their families and sent to missions and other institutions. Again, not quite the same in terms of these students being found, but policies that we look back and say that was a thing that didn't respect, you know, an approach that didn't respect the importance of family and culture to a number of Indigenous cultures around the world. So the church and the government equally have to take responsibility for what happened. And, you know, we need to get to the someone needs to get to the bottom of what happened, and then we can probably have a more nuanced conversation about what ought to have happened that didn't, or what happened that ought not to have happened. So, but certainly there's a great sadness that the church appears to have been involved in something that falls short of what we would consider to be the appropriate support of children. And yeah, whether they were buried without that respect for them as human beings would be, you know, a terrible thing in and of itself. But let's find out what else might be behind it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Anna, you were mentioning in the pre-show, you know, there's been unfortunately similar stories, I think you were saying, in Ireland, and what they ended up uncovering was natural causes, but disrespect for the dead. It's kind of the stuff of horror movies, isn't it? When you sort of hear these kind of numbers in a school, and, you know, and the comment about colonialist tendencies, or what was the phrasing that was used, you know, the government's position, the government's colonialist policies, is, you know, obviously something which is a sore point as the world kind of wakes up to the realities of Indigenous people being persecuted and continuing to be persecuted today in different situations around the world as well. What did you make of this relatively macabre story?
Well, I feel like I'm not sure why the apology was given at this stage, where there isn't the, you know, that we don't really know. We actually, I think, Don, you mentioned a mass grave, but certainly in this article they don't necessarily talk about that. And from 1890 to 1978, 200 children could have died just through natural causes or whatever, and been buried as we normally bury our people, but maybe in unmarked graves or something like that. So they're not necessarily thrown in a big pit. Like, we don't know that. And, well, actually, they would probably know how they were buried because they dug them up. But, like, whether it was some kind of, oh, yeah, this is the dead pit and we just throw the children in here when they die, or were they actually buried as if, like, you know, that normally maybe they had funerals, but maybe they were kids who, I don't know, did they not have families? Did they, you know, like, we just, we have no information, and yet already there's this implication that obviously the Catholic Church has done something terrible, and maybe they have, because the church has done stuff like that before, but we don't know. So what's the point of apologizing? Get all the facts, and then you can make an apology that's clear and directed to the people who deserve it. Because he talks about, I wish to apologize sincerely and profoundly to the survivors and their families. I'm like, survivors of what, that school? Like, as in, are they, I don't know. Like, there's one thing to apologize that the school wasn't a very good place to be. But is that the same thing if, yeah, I just find it like, we, what is there to apologize for right now? Because we don't really know what's unfolded there as far as.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, I mean, good point.
It's possible. I mean, it's possible that the Archbishop knows plenty more than we do. In fact, he probably does. But yeah, I think the sooner the public know a bit more about it, the better that would be. And no doubt there are government inquiries and all sorts of things.
I think that there was another, the other example of this, which was in another country, was that they were, it wasn't like the children all died at the same time. It was like over a number of decades where you'd, and you know, any kind of place for perhaps orphans or whatever, like you had deaths, like people die, like that's kind of part of the normal consequence of life, right? And so they had buried the children, and then, but I guess the knowledge of where the children were buried was lost. And so then later, years later, they find these graves, and then they immediately think, oh, someone, you know, something really horrible's happened here. But yet perhaps at the time, those children were buried with dignity, maybe even with a mass, who knows? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's a really good point.
We just don't know.
It's a really good point, because I saw this article when it, you know, initially was in the mainstream press, and of course the headlines and everything are pointing to, you know, the church, because it is this element of, you know, well, like they've done terrible things before, Catholics, those Catholics, and you know, I mean, yes, and at the same time people do horrible things. So yeah, it's a really good point. Actually, we don't really have the data. We should get the facts. I'm sure there are plenty of inquiries and reviews underway, and maybe we should wait for those till we cast judgment.
Yeah, I mean, there's a danger of really looking at this case through a kind of 2021 lens, and we have to remember how long ago it was, and mortality stats, and children's mortality is not, and medicine is not where it was, and pediatrics where it is today. So having a look at that through that lens, and certainly there's, because this is a First Nations issue, there's the, you know, the social justice issue, which unfortunately in this day and age automatically assumes that any interaction between white people and First Nations people was necessarily of a conqueror versus kind of victim type of mentality. So those are probably, you know, two things in terms of the 2021 lens that people are looking at this issue through.
It's a good point. Like, it is a story like this that has got, you know, it's a different time and place. And again, there is a lot of appetite for reviewing the past through modern lens, not always to the best outcome. But yes, well, we'll monitor the story and see what happens, see what comes out of it. Obviously, if the church was implicated in was involved in something that is less than right, then that's terrible, and there should be remedies for it, no doubt about it. Right, this next one is, let's go a little bit more local, shall we? This is from catholic.org.nz. New Zealand Catholics bishop, sorry, my plurals are off there. New Zealand's Catholic bishops have welcomed Pope Francis's approval of the new Book 6 of the Church's Code of Canon Law, which toughens and extends sanctions against sexual abuse. Bishop of Hamilton Stephen Lowe, secretary of the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Conference, says the new code makes it clear that bishops must take decisive action when abuse is reported to them. The upgraded code makes punishment for offences compulsory under canon law, as opposed to suggested, as in the previous version. All right, we'll come back to that. It also now includes abusive adults and vulnerable people, described as persons with an imperfect use of reason, as well as the persons under 16 covered by the previous code. It says that a priest who abuses, commits indecent exposure, or grooms someone, quote, is to be punished with the deprivation of office and with other just penalties, not excluding, where the case calls for it, dismissal from the clerical state, end quote. Oh, new quote. This is from Bishop Lowe. This new chapter of canon law sets out how the church must deal with abusers in addition to the criminal law sanctions, said Bishop Lowe. It removes a bishop's former discretion to use canon law to punish someone who has committed abuse. The church's canon law exists alongside the civil and criminal law of the land, he added. This revision of canon law covers the discipline of the church alongside and beyond the civil law, covering, for example, processes for church discipline in the light of civil prosecution, or for matters that might not meet the criteria for a civil prosecution. This affirming and widening by Pope Francis of the canon law provisions against abuse is welcome and timely, especially as it comes during the Royal Commission on Abuse and Care, which the Catholic Church strongly supports, said Bishop Lowe. The Catholic Church accepts the responsibility to act when abuse occurs in the church. We will act by listening, learning, and supporting those affected by abuse. We will act swiftly on complaints and follow them through. We will hold those to account who have been proven responsible for abuse. This upgrading of canon law affirms that. End quote. Gavin, I've got to come back. I've got to come back to that comment. The upgraded code makes punishment for offences compulsory under canon law as opposed to suggested, as in the previous version. That's quite an upgrade. I have to disagree with the good bishop on how timely that upgrade is. One would have thought we could have upgraded that law a little bit sooner.
Well, so that not to excuse it, but the last edition of the full code of canon law was 1983. So there
Book
was
five. The law strikes back. Was that was in 83? Was it? It's about the 83 is oh, no 19. When did it come out? 88? Oh, no, 80 was Empire. Sorry, carry on. Yes, sorry. Yeah. So it's a bit of a different time.
Well, so and again, the 2021 lens can be very helpful or very challenging. The understanding of, in my work recently, done an interview with someone who's just written a book about abuse inquiries, actually, and the desire to look at what happened in the 1960s, 70s, or 80s through our current understanding of various things is very strong. The temptation to do that is very strong. And there's a nobility in trying to do that. But the reality is that a lot of things that we would now consider certainly violations of a priest's promises that he makes at ordination or vows if he's a religious, or she for that matter, were not criminal at that time. Some of them aren't criminal now, yet they certainly would fall outside the church's understanding of what's appropriate. And so I guess think back to one of the earlier stories, there has been a lot of progress made, and we can certainly argue that the progress has been too slow, and in many cases that's certainly true. There is continual progress on this matter, and this is sort of the latest in a series of steps in this area. So in 2018, I think it was, Pope Francis summoned the presidents of the bishops' conferences for a big summit in Rome. I think it was 2019 when he issued a motu proprio on the handling of abuse by priests and religious. There was other documentation around that. Even in the last two or three years, there continues to be the strengthening at the global level, mindful that much of what's been taking place has been at the local level in terms of the implementation of particular policies and procedures by bishops' conferences or by dioceses to address this matter. So, there are certainly some things that you thought, okay, well, maybe it ought not have taken 40 years for us, for our thinking on this to evolve. The canon law provisions are important for the church globally. There's no doubt about that. But I suspect what you would find, and again, Australia and New Zealand being the contexts that we know best, I would think some of the way things were already being implemented would, you know, we're ahead of this particular change in canon law in some of these areas because there are already protocols and procedures in place for how things were to be treated. And that 2019 document had already made some progress that maybe wasn't codified in canon law yet. So some of this is a sort of a ratification of things that have already been either, you know, normative practice or, you know, mandated in a particular place or both. So that's just a little bit of context I might offer in response to your question.
No, that's great context. So put it, just, you know, paraphrasing that, it's kind of closing any not a loophole, but any holes in the canon law to be able to say, right, well, local practice is already accounting for some of these things anyway. Let's now just make it really crystal clear. Above all else, canon law kind of overrules it all, and, you know, sorry, not overrules it all. From a canon law point of view, I like the point around it sitting alongside civil and criminal, the three C's of law, I guess, and if you're in the church. This is good. From my point of view, I'm not going to ask if anyone doesn't think it's good, because obviously I'm sure we're all on the same page. But Anna, I mean, it's interesting to sort of say, you know, it has taken a bit of time for this law to be revised. I mean, you think the parliament moves slow. You know, 30 years, 40 years since the last one. I don't know. What do you make of this, or what the Bishop Lowe's saying about the change in code?
I wonder if... I've never really studied canon law, and it's quite a particular subject, I guess. It's not always straightforward to understand. But I think the problem was not that there weren't those laws in place, but that they perhaps were phrased in a way that allowed the bishop to use his judgment. And perhaps, like, use his own judgment in applying them. It wasn't that there was nothing, no provisions to do the things that the canon law is now saying should be done. I think it was always in there, but the wording's changed in order to eliminate, perhaps, the judgment of the bishop. So, you know, they use the words, he must do this, or should do, you know, like the language has changed. I think really that's my understanding of what's come through. So that it's not that it was necessarily ambiguous, but perhaps there just wasn't, maybe there was a little bit of space for interpretation, which in some cases is important in law, because each kind of circumstance can be quite different from the other. So perhaps there was a little bit of discretion that was in the law before, and I think that's been certainly narrowed, if not removed altogether. And we might say that's a really good thing, but maybe that could be problematic sometimes as well. So like Gavin was saying, like, you know, perhaps what's happening now, well, what's already been happening is those laws are being applied now in a way that they should have been perhaps in the past. And now the law is reflecting, using a language that's much more sort of rigid. But yeah, I might be quite wrong in that, but that's my impression of certainly the sexual abuse stuff. But, you know, that whole chapter covers a whole lot of stuff, about the ordination or the use of sacraments without valid matter, which, you know, there's been problems with baptismal formulas.
All right,
but invalid matter is also, like, say, for instance, if you're ordaining someone, the valid matter for ordination is a baptized male. So, you know, if you're trying to ordain a woman, you know, so
or an unbaptized man, I presume.
Or an unbaptized man. Yeah, exactly. So it does cover, like, quite a range of things, because it's the penal, it's like the punishment area. Like, what kind of punishments are due to these certain crimes? And so sexual abuse is sort of one part of it. But another aspect of it as well was that, you know, if you've been accused of sexual abuse or something along those lines, you actually, the person who's been accused now can make sure, like, that they have a right that the process only takes 3 years. Because for some, particularly priests and stuff, like, they're still languishing 10 years down the track. You know, things haven't, they haven't made any kind of progress in investigation or whatever, and they're just in limbo. And, you know, all that kind of stuff, which for the accused and for the accuser, that's important as well. So just a whole lot of things, I think. But I think the reality as well, another thing to think about is, like, we talk about the slowness of the changes. And yes, we, you know, changes did need to be made, I guess. The church has discerned that they should have been made. But we're not, for the most part, we're not, we're talking about historical things, especially in regard, with regard to the sexual abuse stuff. So we're not having to make changes in order to catch people now. We are still, we're able to bring people to justice already, as the laws were, but they've just been tightened up, I guess, to some degree. And so it's not just, well, maybe it's just made it clearer what the bishop, what his role is or what he must do in those things.
The removing of the discretion of the bishop, I think, is really, you know, that's a really good read on it. And it's one of those things where, I don't know, Don, I always find that when we talk about these matters as it relates to the abuse crisis, you know, we are left with, it's hard to have a rational response, right? It's very easy to be, you know, emotional, angry, you know, furious at the past, at the recent past. So there's almost a part of me that goes, yeah, absolutely, no, they shouldn't have any discretion. Take it all away. But I've seen really poorly worded laws also causing problems in the civil and criminal situation. So maybe the same thing happens in a canon point of view. I don't know, mate. What did you make of this this expansion and what it means?
Oh, I think it's great. As you're saying, that be hard to find a man who would disagree with this, and basically it closes a lot of loopholes, and hopefully loopholes that didn't really exist in the first place. I guess something that really struck out to me was just the discretion around the defrocking, where it says if someone's found guilty of abuse or public exposure or grooming, then basically says where the case calls for it, you know, the removal from the clerical state or defrocking, as we kind of know it, where applicable. And I guess the thing that stood out to me was, you know, why is that discretionary? But then I think we take our minds back to the Pell case, where there was generally was a lot of feeling and thought in the Catholic community that justice wasn't being done, despite what the kind of secular courts were saying. And I think it was, yeah, probably the right call. Well, it was the right call there to keep Pell in the clerical state, and certainly it would have been a massive emotional torment to him if he was defrocked. I think it certainly helped to keep him sane during his time when he was wrongly imprisoned. So I guess, yeah. But the better part of me says that in 99% of cases, yeah, that discretion should probably be gone. And where you have proven instances of abuse or grooming or indecent exposure, that there shouldn't be that discretion around defrocking.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I've often found it weird when priests are defrocked or not. It's obviously something you've got to take very seriously, but it's kind of hard to get some consistency on that. Well, we'll continue to watch for future canon law changes, and we will call them out. And even though we're not experts ourselves, it's always good to sort of follow and see what's happening in this space. This is one of those things, I think, where, yeah, it's a hard one, Gavin. It's a hard one, that one, given that none of us... Well, it's not a hard one in terms of expanding the law, but like kind of commenting on the law, because the more I think about it, the more I kind of think about, oh, what about this and how would they handle that and what about this situation? And so, you know, maybe it's not as simple as at first glance it appears.
It's usually not with canon law, and I'm even less of an expert than Anna on canon law. yes, objects may be closer than they appear or further away, but we're not quite sure.
Yeah, we're not sure. So something like those lines. So let's try and cover for both. You know, I don't know if anyone's going to give out any awards for good laws or not, but maybe they'll give them out for good sheds. This is for our last story, which is a great story, Gavin. I love it. This is from The Scotsman, and no, I will not be doing any Scottish accents. A Highland priest is up against the creators of a bra-fitting boutique and a Chitty Chitty Bang Bang inspired inventor's workshop in the 2021 Shed of the Year competition. That's right. Forget about the Oscars. Forget about the Emmys. It's the Shed of the Year. That's what you want to be going for. The lockdown category, introduced in last year's competition. Oh, interesting. It hasn't been a long-standing category. The lockdown category has been retained, with several DIY bars created as pubs were closed until Corona... with several DIY bars that were created as pubs were closed until coronavirus restrictions began to ease. This year, 331 entrants are vying for the title of Cupranol Shed of the Year. Sounds like it needs to have, like, you know, echo and reverb. More than double the number than in 2020. In the competition's 15th year, Father Len Black from Inverness has made it to the finals with Summerhouse The Oratory of St. Joseph. The Catholic priests stream mass from the shed every day during lockdown, attracting viewers from Essex to Australia. Father Black said,
"Not
New Zealand. No, we didn't go that far. Maybe down in Invercargill, might have." Father Black said, "My shed started life as a 6-foot by 6-foot summer house about 22 years ago when I bought it in kit form in a charity auction for around £100. The shed, known as the Oratory of St. Joseph, has been a work in progress over the years, and all who come to mass each week say it's a haven of tranquility in a quiet garden not far from the centre of Inverness." We must put a link to this in the show notes so you can go have a look at this. It's like quite an impressive shed. And I didn't realize that sheds were... I mean, when I think shed, I think like a garden shed. And I tell you what, any garden shed I've seen doesn't quite look like the Oratory of St. Joseph. Oh, this is just a fantastic little story, sort of seeing what they're doing there. The priest, Father Black, was originally an Anglican priest, I noted. And then...
Yeah, so he was... and now he's a member of the Personal Ordinariate.
Right.
So the Anglican, the people who prefer the Anglican form of worship.
Ah, but he's a Catholic priest now.
Yes, yeah. So this is, you know, many years ago, Pope Benedict came out with Anglicanorum Citibus or something like that, which was a document essentially allowing people who were Anglican to become full members of full communion with the Catholic Church while retaining some of the Anglican worship.
Oh, like the Common Book of Prayer and things like that.
Well, so, yeah, so there's certainly communities that Australia has its own personal ordinariate of Our Lady of the Southern Cross, for example. I don't know if that ordinariate assists with New Zealand or not. I think there are is there an Anglican ordinariate parish in New Zealand? I think there might be. He's a fully fledged Catholic priest, but had been an Anglican priest before Pope Benedict's invitation.
Well, he's hoping he wins. He's up against...
Oh, let's hope so. I was trying to find, because this story's from, you know, a week or 10 days ago, and I was trying to find the results, but was unable to do so. But let's hope he does.
Well, I mean, I'd be keen to find out. We'll have to follow up. We're gonna have to follow up on the next episode and sort of see where the Father Black wins against 330 other entrants, including the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang inspired Inventor's Workshop.
I do like that book.
Is it a book? I remember the movie.
Kikuchi Bang Bang?
Yeah, is it a book?
Oh, it's like anything. There's a book first.
Yeah, usually. Yeah, that's the way it usually works. Yeah. Mm. I don't know. Anna, what do you reckon? You're going to sort of open the oratory of, I don't know, Our Lady of Canberra?
Our Lady of Canberra.
Don't know. I hadn't really considered it, but maybe I might be inspired by this final.
Like,
final
go look at the photos. I'm like, it's pretty awesome, Don. It's. I mean, I'd love. You know, you got it. You come on, mate. You'd be up for having like a garden shed, like a shed that's like an incredible, you know, shrine as well.
I'm not shit over heels about it.
Oh, wow. So bad.
Yeah.
I have to find the trombone sound effect for that one. Yeah.
Oh, the drums. Ba-dum boom.
Yeah. Well, look, we wish you all the best, Father Black. If you haven't won already, we hope you do. That's awesome. Fantastic. And what a wonderful way to connect with people in lockdown and still very much celebrating, you know, his culture and things like, well done. That's awesome. And if you want to go back and listen to previous episodes and see if we've, you know, had other discussions of Shed of the Year, spoiler alert, we haven't, or whether Don's made other puns, spoiler alert, he has, you can go and find them at www.station15.co.nz. There you can subscribe for free, despite the moves by Apple and Spotify and the like. We're still free. It's free. It's right. Tell all your friends. You can subscribe for free there or on Apple iTunes or Google Play or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. You should be able to find us. Just search for The 15th Station. If you are using some sort of podcast or podcatcher and you don't find The 15th Station, send us an email to podcast@station15.co.nz or feedback@station15.co.nz. They both work. We'd always love to hear from you. And you can find us at twitter.com/station15 and facebook.com/station15. Just leaves me to thank everyone for making the time. Thanks very much, Don. Great to chat with you, buddy.
Likewise. Thank you, James.
Always a highlight to talk with you, Anna. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks, James.
And thanks, Gavin. Thanks for bringing us all together, buddy. As always, great to chat.
You too, James. Have a great month.
Thank you. I will try, and I hope that everyone out there has a great month as well. June's a great month. Enjoy it. If you're in our part of the world, you know, hunker down, some you know, electric blanket and a bit of a nice hot cup of tea. And if you're in the northern hemisphere, enjoy the summer. And hopefully, what we're starting to see is coronavirus letting go. That'd be fantastic if it could just stop. That'd be fine. Thanks very much. But we hope that you all have a great month ahead. And until next time, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.